By the time the sirens reached the quiet streets of Pinellas Park, Florida, it was already too late. On April 14, 2009, 18-year-old Sarah Ludeman lay bleeding from a single fatal stab wound. The girl accused of wielding the knife was just 19, Rachel Wade. Their connection? A boy named Josh. But this wasn't just teenage drama. This was the violent climax of an escalating rivalry fueled by jealousy, late-night threats, and digital harassment. Two lives collided in a perfect storm of insecurity and obsession. One would die. The other would be branded a murderer before she was old enough to drink. And behind it all, a love triangle so toxic it blurred the line between victim and villain. This is not a cautionary tale about teen romance. It's a chilling portrait of emotional manipulation, social media warfare, and how far some will go to win. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Small Town, Big Emotions. Pinellas Park, Florida, sits just a short drive from the Gulf Coast. Quiet, residential, and mostly uneventful. The kind of town where fast food restaurants line the main strip and teenagers gather in parking lots because there's not much else to do after dark. It wasn't known for violent crime or national headlines. But in April 2009, that all changed. The high school corridors of Pinellas Park buzzed with the usual drama: crushes, parties, whispered rumors. Among the students were two girls, Rachel Wade and Sarah Ludeman, who, at first glance, seemed like polar opposites. Rachel was outspoken and intense, a 19-year-old waitress with a sharp tongue and a reputation for not backing down from confrontation. She had dropped out of school, but kept a tight circle of friends. Her MySpace page featured cryptic quotes and brooding selfies, the kind that reflected a girl searching for meaning, validation, and maybe a little revenge. She wasn't someone you crossed lightly. Sarah, a year younger at 18, was cheerful and trusting. She had a soft presence, someone more likely to de-escalate than confront. Still in school and close to her family, Sarah was often described as kind-hearted and, when detectives played back the voicemail she had left Sarah just days earlier, "You're gonna regret it." The room shifted. This wasn't about fear. This was premeditation. A town in shock news of the stabbing spread fast. By morning, it was the lead story across Florida. Two teenage girls, one dead, one in jail. A love triangle that spiraled into tragedy. The community was stunned. Parents asked how no one saw this coming. Teachers wondered if they missed signs. Friends posted tributes online. Sarah's softball team left her jersey hanging on the dugout fence. Her classmates held a candlelight vigil. Rachel's mugshot hit the internet within hours. Blank expression, hair pulled back, eyes empty. People took sides. Some defended her, saying she was provoked, tormented, pushed to the edge. Others called it murder, plain and cold. But the facts were no longer whispers. They were evidence, texts, voicemails, witnesses, the knife. One life ended, another changed forever. In the aftermath, Josh Camacho vanished from the public eye. He didn't attend Sarah's funeral. He didn't publicly speak on Rachel's behalf. The boy both girls fought for had disappeared, leaving behind two broken families and a town demanding answers. As Rachel sat in her jail cell awaiting trial, the reality began to set in. She would no longer be going back to her apartment. She would not be returning to her job. Her future, like Sarah's, had ended that night, just in a different way, and the war they had waged through text messages, voicemails, and teenage rage had left a permanent scar on the place they called home. Chapter 5, The Investigation. When detectives entered the interrogation room where Rachel Wade sat just hours after the stabbing, they weren't walking into a mystery. They already had a body, a weapon, a motive, and a string of threatening voicemails. What they needed now was clarity and proof that this wasn't an act of self-defense, but premeditated murder. Rachel, 19 years old and visibly drained, wasn't combative. She spoke softly. Her arms were folded. Her voice, at times, cracked. Not with tears, but with frustration. She repeated her version of events. She came at me. I didn't mean to stab her. I was scared. I didn't want to die. But the physical evidence told a different story, the forensic picture. The single stab wound to Sarah Ludeman's chest had punctured her heart. The knife entered with such force and precision that it caused massive internal bleeding. There were no defensive wounds on Sarah's hands or arms, an important detail. It suggested that Sarah had not fought back. There was also no evidence of struggle at the scene. No torn clothing, no bruising, no scratches on Rachel. Police reviewed multiple eyewitness statements, each confirming the same thing. Sarah was standing near the van, unarmed and passive, when Rachel charged and stabbed her. Then there was the knife itself, a kitchen knife taken from a friend's apartment earlier that evening. It wasn't a pocket knife or something Rachel carried regularly. She had deliberately taken it, tucked it into her purse, and brought it with her to the scene. Detectives now had to determine one thing. Was the murder premeditated, or was it a split-second decision in the heat of the moment? Building the case. The state attorney's office quickly moved to charge Rachel Wade with second-degree murder. Unlike first-degree murder, which requires proof of detailed planning, second-degree focuses on a depraved mind without regard for human life. That standard fit the facts well, especially when prosecutors reviewed the mountain of digital evidence Rachel had left behind. There were voicemails with direct threats, text messages about getting even, MySpace posts referring to violence and revenge, witnesses who recalled Rachel pacing outside, waiting for Sarah. In one message, sent just one day before the stabbing, Rachel texted a friend, "If I see her again, I swear I'll snap." That message alone became a key piece of evidence for prosecutors who argued Rachel wasn't reacting. She was hunting. Public reaction and media frenzy. As the investigation unfolded, local and national media jumped on the story. A love triangle. Two pretty teenage girls. A charming but irresponsible boyfriend. A stabbing in the night. The press painted Rachel as the jealous ex-turned-killer. Headlines like "Fatal Obsession in Florida" and "Teen Rivalry Turns Deadly" splashed across TV and newspapers. Tabloids used MySpace photos to dramatize the case, while talk shows debated whether social media had become the new battleground for teenage rage. Meanwhile, Sarah's family mourned quietly. Her parents, Gail and Thomas, were shattered. In court appearances, they sat stoically, refusing to comment to the press in the early days. But behind closed doors, they struggled with the weight of losing their only daughter to something they described as senseless and avoidable. Rachel's family was equally devastated. Her parents claimed their daughter wasn't a monster, just a girl who snapped under pressure. They blamed Josh, social media, and a lack of intervention from schools and police. But for prosecutors, the blame didn't matter as much as the proof, and they had it, the role of Josh Camacho. Throughout the investigation, Josh Camacho remained elusive. He cooperated with police, but gave minimal commentary. In interviews, he downplayed his role in the rivalry. "I never told them to fight. I didn't want this," he said. But detectives noticed how he had lied to both girls, promised exclusivity to both, and failed to warn either about the growing danger. In the weeks before the stabbing, Josh had sent flirtatious texts to Rachel while simultaneously posting photos with Sarah. He had told Rachel, "I miss you," days before telling Sarah, "You're the only one." His name was all over the case, but he would never face charges. Florida law didn't allow prosecution for emotional manipulation or incitement in this context. That didn't stop the public from blaming him. Online forums and Facebook pages began calling him the puppet master, the boy who watched two girls destroy each other while refusing to take responsibility. Rachel's first court appearance came within 48 hours of her arrest. She wore a county-issued jumpsuit and stood behind bulletproof glass, eyes wide but dry. The judge read the charge, second-degree murder. Her bond was denied. She would await trial in jail. Her attorney spoke to the media briefly, stating, "We intend to argue that Rachel acted in fear for her life. She was threatened repeatedly. She was not the aggressor." But it was a steep uphill battle. Public sentiment leaned heavily against her. The prosecution had voicemails, photos, and more than a dozen witnesses. And perhaps most devastating, Sarah's final autopsy report, which showed she had died within minutes, with no signs of a struggle. She never stood a chance. A broken community. The investigation left a scar on Pinellas Park. Parents held emergency meetings at local schools. Teachers were asked to report signs of bullying or obsession. Mental health counselors were brought in to talk to students. It wasn't just about Rachel and Sarah anymore. It was about what everyone missed. How many people saw the warnings and stayed silent? How many times had Rachel hinted at violence? How many nights had Sarah feared for her safety but said nothing? The investigation revealed what everyone now knew but couldn't admit soon enough. It didn't have to end like this. Chapter 6, Trial by Jury and Social Media. By August 2010, over a year after the stabbing death of Sarah Ludeman, the trial of Rachel Wade was underway in Pinellas County, Florida. The courthouse buzzed with reporters, family members, and members of a community still raw with emotion. Inside, the courtroom was packed. Rachel, now 20, sat beside her defense attorney in a navy blouse, hair pulled back tightly, eyes sunken but focused. Across the aisle sat Sarah's family, her parents, Gail and Thomas, somber, quiet, surrounded by supporters in black ribbons. No cameras were allowed inside during the proceedings, but the story was being broadcast on nightly news and dissected in real time across Facebook, Twitter, and blogs. The question before the court was not who killed Sarah. That was clear. The question was why, and whether Rachel Wade had acted in self-defense or if she had gone looking for blood. The prosecution's case, premeditated rage. Prosecutor Lizette Fernandez wasted no time laying out her narrative. Rachel Wade had become obsessed, consumed by jealousy over a boy who never truly belonged to either girl. She had stalked Sarah, harassed her, threatened her. And on April 14th, 2009, she hunted her down, pulled a knife from her purse, and plunged it into Sarah's chest with intent to kill. Fernandez played Rachel's own words for the jury. "You keep pushing me, and I swear you'll regret it. You have no idea what I'm capable of." These weren't just threats, the prosecutor argued. They were forewarnings of murder. She introduced witnesses, neighbors, friends, and bystanders who testified to Rachel's rage. One witness recalled Rachel circling Sarah's neighborhood at night. Another said she told them weeks earlier that she was going to handle it once and for all. Then came the autopsy report, which showed Sarah had no defensive wounds, no weapon, and a fatal stab wound to the heart. A clean, intentional strike. Rachel didn't react as the graphic photos were introduced into evidence, but her father quietly left the courtroom. The defense, a girl who snapped. Rachel's attorney, Jay Hebert, had a different story. He told the jury Rachel was not a killer, but a frightened young woman pushed too far. She was threatened. She was taunted. She was terrified. He played voicemails left by Sarah, including one where Sarah called Rachel a psycho and warned her to back off. He emphasized that Sarah had once followed Rachel to a friend's house and tried to fight her in public. These weren't isolated threats, the defense argued. They were part of a pattern of mutual hostility. Hebert insisted Rachel only brought the knife that night because she feared Sarah. He claimed Sarah had rushed at her, that Rachel stabbed in panic. It was one motion, 1 second, and it changed everything. But the forensics and eyewitnesses didn't support that theory. None of them saw Sarah attack. And Rachel had no visible injuries, not even a scratch. The power of digital evidence. Central to the prosecution's case was the trail of digital breadcrumbs Rachel left behind. Angry text messages, threatening voicemails, and posts on MySpace that painted a picture of a girl spiraling out of control. But perhaps the most damning evidence was her final voicemail, left just hours before Sarah died. "You're dead, you hear me? Dead." The courtroom fell silent after the recording played. Jurors looked shaken. One woman wiped tears from her eyes. The prosecutor walked slowly to the jury box. "Ladies and gentlemen, those weren't words spoken in fear. Those were words spoken in hate." Sarah's family speaks. During the victim impact portion, Gail Ludeman took the stand. She held a framed photo of Sarah, smiling, in her softball jersey. Her voice cracked as she spoke. "My daughter was kind. She didn't deserve this. She was not a threat. She wanted to live." The courtroom was silent. Even Rachel looked down, her eyes glassy. Sarah's father did not speak. He stood at the back of the courtroom, arms crossed tightly over his chest. The verdict. After 6 days of testimony and 2 days of deliberation, the jury returned. Rachel stood as the verdict was read. "We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of second-degree murder." Rachel blinked hard, but showed no emotion. She was immediately taken into custody. During sentencing, the judge addressed her directly. "You made a choice, Miss Wade, a final, irreversible choice, and now you will face the consequences." Rachel Wade was sentenced to 27 years in prison. The online reaction. The trial ignited heated debates across social media. Supporters of Rachel launched online petitions claiming her sentence was too harsh. Others said she deserved more, life, even death. Many blamed Josh Camacho, who was notably absent from the trial. He had not testified. He had not appeared. He had, in many ways, disappeared. Sarah's friends flooded her Facebook page with tributes. Rachel's old MySpace profile became a digital graveyard, frozen in time, a place where anger, love, and desperation collided. A legal outcome, but no closure. After the sentencing, Sarah's parents addressed the media for the first time. "We don't hate Rachel. We just wish she had walked away," Gail said. "None of this had to happen. None of it." Rachel's parents declined to comment. As she was led away in shackles, Rachel paused for a moment. She looked out at the courtroom, not at her family, not at the judge, but at the ground, and then she was gone. Chapter 7, Aftermath and Lessons. Unlearned with the gavel struck and the sentence delivered, Rachel Wade disappeared into the Florida prison system, inmate number 5565. She was 20 years old and would not be eligible for release until her late 40s. But even behind bars, the story did not end, because what happened between Rachel Wade and Sarah Ludeman wasn't just about two girls and a boy. It was about something larger, something that spoke to the way obsession, social media, and emotional manipulation collide in dangerous ways. And in the years that followed, no one walked away untouched. Life behind bars. Rachel was transferred to Lowell Correctional Institution, a women's prison known for housing some of Florida's most high-profile female inmates. In prison interviews conducted by journalists and advocates, Rachel appeared calm but introspective. In one televised segment, she sat across from a reporter and said, "I didn't mean to kill her. I never wanted her to die. I lost control." When asked if she took responsibility, she paused. "I should have walked away. I should have let go. I wish I could change that night." But even in her regrets, Rachel often returned to the pain she said she felt during the months leading up to the stabbing, the jealousy, the fear, the pressure to compete for Josh's attention. "He told us both we were his girl. He played us." Still, for Sarah's family, the apologies felt hollow, because while Rachel had lost her freedom, Sarah had lost her life. A family's grief. Gail and Thomas Ludeman remained private in the years following the trial. Friends say they turned inward, focusing on healing and honoring their daughter's memory. Sarah's bedroom remained untouched for years. Her trophies, softball mitt, and frame prom photos left where she last placed them. At school, a memorial scholarship was created in Sarah's name, awarded to a senior who embodied her kindness, loyalty, and quiet strength. At the first ceremony, Gail stood before a group of high school students and said, "Sarah never raised her fists. She tried to take the high road. I hope that's what people remember, not how she died, but how she lived." The boy who watched it burn, Josh Camacho, the catalyst at the center of the deadly triangle, never faced charges. He moved out of state, reportedly started a new relationship, and vanished from public life. Rumors swirled. Some said he joined the military, others that he was working in construction. But what was clear was that he never publicly expressed remorse. When asked in a rare interview whether he felt responsible, he replied, "No one told them to fight. I didn't make anyone do anything." But many disagreed. In online forums and documentary segments, Josh was referred to as the invisible hand, the one who manipulated, who lied, who stoked the fire while claiming innocence. To Sarah's friends, he was a coward. To Rachel's supporters, he was an instigator. To both families, he was a name they didn't speak out loud. The role of social media. Perhaps the most sobering takeaway from the case wasn't about romance or rivalry, but about the power of social media to escalate emotion. Back in 2009, Facebook and MySpace were the new digital frontier for teenagers. Fights, once confined to whispers in hallways, were now public, permanent, and performative. Girls used posts, likes, and photos as weapons. Each update was a move in a psychological chess game, watched by dozens, sometimes hundreds, of peers. After the trial, schools across Pinellas County began implementing new policies. Students were encouraged to report online harassment. Parents were educated on monitoring digital behavior. Counselors were trained to recognize signs of emotional distress, not just from bruises, but from statuses and screenshots. But it came too late for Sarah. Could this have been stopped? That question still hangs heavy in Pinellas Park. Could the school have intervened earlier? Should Rachel's threats have been taken more seriously? Why didn't Sarah report the voicemails? Why didn't Josh walk away? Why didn't anyone stop the spiral? The answers vary. But what's undeniable is that multiple people saw the signs, and no one connected them in time. Rachel wasn't a career criminal. Sarah wasn't reckless. They were teenagers, caught in a cycle of emotional dependency and manipulation, magnified by immaturity and fueled by a boy who gave them both just enough attention to keep them hoping. And when that hope collapsed, so did everything else. A warning still echoing. More than a decade later, the Rachel Wade case is still taught in criminal justice courses, featured in documentaries, and dissected in true crime podcasts, not because it's sensational, but because it's so heartbreakingly ordinary. Two girls, one boy, 100 chances to stop it, none taken. Sarah died because Rachel brought a knife, one juror said, but she also died because too many people thought this was just high school drama. Rachel Wade remains incarcerated. Her earliest release date is 2032, assuming good behavior and parole eligibility. She will likely walk free one day. Sarah Ludeman will not. And in the space between their two stories lies a truth our society still hasn't fully grasped. Words matter. Jealousy kills. And silence can be fatal. Loyal, especially when it came to people she loved. She played softball, had a curfew, and rarely broke the rules. But even the kindest people have limits, especially when pushed. Their lives would have never crossed if not for one person, Josh Camacho. Josh was the type of guy who didn't stay single for long. At 21, he had a magnetic charm, especially with younger girls. His friends called him smooth. His critics called him a manipulator. To some, he was a bad boy with swagger. To others, a player who kept women in competition with one another to boost his ego. Either way, he became the center of a love triangle that would ignite a deadly storm. Josh and Rachel had a history, passionate, volatile, and anything but stable. They fought. They made up. And they always seemed to come back to each other. When they weren't together, he drifted to others. That's when Sarah entered the picture. Unlike Rachel, Sarah offered Josh something simpler: comfort, sweetness, safety. But Josh didn't want to choose, and he didn't have to. Not when both girls were so desperate to keep him. It wasn't long before Sarah and Rachel realized they weren't alone. The discovery didn't come with a confession. It came with phone calls, messages, and growing suspicion. Rachel began receiving texts warning her to stay away. Sarah started getting cryptic threats. Social media posts and voicemails painted a picture of two young women fighting for emotional territory over a man who was giving just enough attention to both. What started as subtle digs, an eye roll in public, a cold stare in the school hallway, grew into something louder, more visible and far more dangerous. Rachel left voicemails laced with venom. "You have no idea what I'm capable of. Stay away from him. You're messing with the wrong person." Sarah told her friends she felt like she was being hunted. But still, she didn't walk away from Josh. Neither of them did. Adults began to notice the tension, but few stepped in. The digital age had created a new kind of battleground. One fought not just in person, but in text messages, status updates, and comments. And in that world, threats could be minimized as drama. Warnings could be mistaken for teenage posturing. But beneath the surface, the hatred was real. Rachel grew more obsessive, keeping tabs on where Sarah went, who she talked to, even what she wore. Sarah, in turn, grew more anxious, telling friends she just wanted Rachel to stop. She never wanted a fight. She just wanted to keep her boyfriend. What neither of them understood, or maybe refused to accept, was that Josh wasn't truly with either of them. He was with whoever gave him the most attention that day. And he kept the feud alive by feeding each girl half-truths and denials, knowing exactly how to spin their insecurities against them. Some of Rachel's friends tried to intervene. One reportedly warned her, "You're going to get yourself into trouble." But she didn't listen. Not because she didn't hear them, because she didn't think they understood. She was in love. And in her mind, Sarah was the one stealing something that belonged to her. The final straw came in early April. Sarah was seen driving Josh's car. Rachel saw them together. She left another voicemail, this time more aggressive, more specific. It ended like this: "You keep pushing me, and I swear you'll regret it." A few days later, Sarah told a friend she was done being afraid. She would confront Rachel if she had to. She wouldn't be bullied into silence. The problem was, Rachel was already preparing for the same confrontation, and neither of them knew that only one would survive it. Chapter 2, A Toxic Triangle. Forms Josh Camacho wasn't just the center of attention. He was the one who pulled the strings. To some, he was just a charismatic, flirtatious 21-year-old with a tendency to bounce from girl to girl. To others, he was the gasoline poured on an already burning fire. And in the months before April 2009, he kept the rivalry between Rachel Wade and Sarah Ludeman alive, even when he claimed he wasn't. By all appearances, Josh didn't want to commit. He was still seeing Rachel behind Sarah's back. And when Rachel would get angry, he'd smooth talk her back into silence. With Sarah, he painted Rachel as the crazy ex who wouldn't let go, while telling Rachel that Sarah meant nothing, that she was just a rebound. But both girls knew better. And both refused to walk away. The triangle wasn't just love and lies. It was territorial war, and neither Rachel nor Sarah was willing to surrender. Every time one tried to take a step forward, the other fought to pull her back. A boy with two faces. Josh's manipulation was subtle but powerful. He would text Rachel flirtatiously, only to show up later with Sarah in public. When Rachel called him out, he'd blame Sarah, saying she wouldn't leave him alone. And Sarah, in turn, believed she was the only real girlfriend. Even when whispers at school and messages on MySpace said otherwise, the digital age allowed everything to play out in plain sight. Friends could see photo uploads, comments, tagged locations, and even when no direct insults were exchanged, the subtext was loud. Sarah once posted a picture of her and Josh kissing, captioned with a heart emoji. Within hours, Rachel left a comment that read simply, "You think you've won. Think again." The threats escalate. Rachel didn't hide her anger. Her voicemails to Sarah turned increasingly aggressive. "You're messing with the wrong girl. I'm done warning you. You think you're untouchable, but I'm not playing anymore." There were no apologies, no backpedaling. She wanted Sarah to feel afraid, but Sarah didn't back down. Instead, she began carrying pepper spray in her purse and told her friend she'd defend herself if she had to. She wasn't looking for a fight, but if Rachel brought one, she wasn't going to run. Sarah's parents were starting to worry. Her mother noticed a change in her, less sleep, more stress, and a look in her eyes that said she wasn't telling the full story. Her father asked if someone was bothering her. She nodded, but insisted it was just girl stuff. But it wasn't. This was emotional warfare. The tension boiled over during a late-night drive. Rachel reportedly followed Sarah in her car, circling her neighborhood. Sarah called a friend in a panic, saying she didn't feel safe. Rachel had started to appear in places she wasn't supposed to be. Parking lots, drive-throughs, even outside Sarah's school. When police were contacted, the line between harassment and teenage drama made intervention difficult. Rachel hadn't technically broken any laws. And while her threats were disturbing, proving criminal intent in voicemail recordings wasn't straightforward. Josh's lies feed the fire. Even as things escalated, Josh refused to take responsibility. When confronted by friends, he shrugged. "They're just crazy. They're fighting over me. What can I do?" But behind the scenes, he was still in contact with both. He would show up at Rachel's house late at night, then take Sarah to lunch the next day. Each girl thought she was winning. In truth, neither was. They were both being used, their insecurities and devotion weaponized against each other. Friends of Rachel tried to intervene. They told her Josh wasn't worth it, that she was losing herself in the obsession. But Rachel wouldn't hear it. She convinced herself that Sarah was the enemy, that if Sarah just stepped aside, things would go back to how they used to be. Sarah, on the other hand, clung to the idea that Rachel would eventually give up. She believed that being the one Josh was seen with publicly gave her the upper hand. They were both wrong. Lines are crossed. In early April 2009, Rachel left a voicemail on Sarah's phone that would later become a centerpiece in the courtroom. "Seriously, I told you to watch your back. I'm not kidding anymore. Next time you see me, you're not going to be smiling." It wasn't empty. It was personal, rage-filled. Sarah saved the message. She played it for a friend who begged her to tell her parents. She didn't. She was scared, but also proud. She didn't want anyone to think she couldn't handle it. Rachel, meanwhile, was growing more erratic. Her social media posts turned dark. She posted lyrics about betrayal, revenge, and heartbreak. In a message sent to Josh, she wrote, "You created this. If I do something crazy, it's because of you." At her job waiting tables, coworkers noticed she seemed distracted, angry one moment, quiet the next. Her manager pulled her aside to ask if she needed time off. She declined, but she was unraveling. The setup. The final days before the murder felt like a slow collapse into something inevitable. Rachel was reportedly told by a friend that Sarah would be out that night with Josh, that they'd be together again. Rachel didn't yell or cry. She just said one word, "Enough." Later that evening, she was seen in dark clothing, pacing outside her home. She told one friend she was going to end it. Another friend, worried, tried to calm her down, but Rachel waved them off. Meanwhile, Sarah was doing what most teenage girls do. She was getting ready for a night out. She didn't know she was being watched. She didn't know her rival had already made up her mind. What no one realized, not Rachel's friends, not Sarah's parents, not even Josh, was that the rivalry had reached its breaking point. And by the time anyone did, it would be too late. Chapter 3, Digital Hostility and Real-World Consequences. By early April 2009, the conflict between Rachel Wade and Sarah Ludeman was no longer just a teenage rivalry. It was a live wire, sparking, dangerous, and overlooked by too many adults who chalked it up to just girls being dramatic. But behind the scenes, the hostility had crossed into something far more dangerous. The battlefield had shifted from school hallways and chance encounters to a place with no rules, no supervision, and no clear limits, the internet. The war on MySpace and phones. Both Rachel and Sarah used MySpace, still popular among teens at the time, as a personal diary and public weapon. Posts became vague but targeted. Song lyrics replaced conversations. Emojis were replaced with threats. Rachel began sharing cryptic messages that, to anyone paying attention, felt like warnings. She thinks she's safe. Cute. This will all end, one way or another. Sarah posted less often, but used photos with Josh to show the world what she believed. She was the real girlfriend. One image in particular stood out. Sarah sitting in Josh's car, wearing his sweatshirt. It was meant to say everything without saying anything. And Rachel saw it. That same night, Rachel called Sarah's phone 16 times. No answer. Then came the voicemail, a now infamous message that would be played in court. "You're a stupid little girl, and you don't know who you're messing with. I swear to God, you will regret this. You have no idea what I'm capable of." It didn't stop there. Rachel followed up with another voicemail, even more direct. "I'm coming for you. I don't care who's watching." Sarah kept the voicemails. She played them for her friends, but she never reported them. Not to school administrators, not to the police, not even to her parents. Whether out of fear, pride, or a desperate belief that this would blow over, she stayed silent. The real world signs. No one took seriously. In the days following the voicemails, things escalated offline. Rachel was seen parked outside Sarah's house. She circled her neighborhood. She sat outside Sarah's job and waited. Once, she followed Sarah to a gas station and stared from her car without speaking. Sarah began telling her close friend she felt stalked. But every time someone urged her to go to the police, she refused. "I don't want to make it worse," she said. But it was already worse. Rachel had started carrying a kitchen knife in her car. Friends would later testify that she mentioned it multiple times, not as protection, but as a warning. "If she comes near me again, I swear." Some laughed it off. Others weren't sure what to do. No one thought it would actually happen. After all, who really believes a teenage girl will kill someone over a boy? That's the mistake so many made. They underestimated just how deeply this rivalry had cut into Rachel's sense of identity. She didn't see herself as a jealous ex. She saw herself as someone who had been replaced, humiliated, and pushed to the edge. And she was determined to make Sarah feel that pain. Red flags everywhere. Josh, of course, played both sides. He told Sarah not to worry about Rachel. "She's just being crazy." He told Rachel the same thing about Sarah. "She's obsessed with me, not my fault." He fed the rivalry, never taking accountability, always keeping just enough distance to avoid blame. But even he admitted later, under police questioning, that he was aware of Rachel's threats. He just didn't think she meant them. Nobody did. And that's where the danger lived, in the gray space between warning and action, between teenage anger and adult violence. The signs were everywhere, but no one connected them fast enough. Rachel's friends saw her unraveling. One friend remembered Rachel shaking during a conversation about Sarah. She said she didn't want to go to jail, the friend said, but she also said she couldn't take it anymore. It wasn't just about Sarah anymore. It was about control, about pain, about making someone pay for every moment Rachel felt replaced, ignored, or powerless. The night before, on April 13, 2009, less than 24 hours before the fatal stabbing, Rachel left a chilling MySpace update. It read, "Tonight will be different. I'm not letting this go." That same night, Sarah spent time with Josh. They drove around, laughed, kissed. She told him she was tired of the drama. She just wanted to be happy. She had no idea that Rachel was watching from a distance. Around midnight, Rachel texted a friend and said, "I'm not going to let her take him. Not anymore." The friend brushed it off. Just more venting. Just another flare-up. But Rachel wasn't venting. She was preparing. She knew where Sarah would be the next day. She knew the route she took home. She knew the moment, the place, and the plan. She didn't say it out loud. She didn't need to. By now, the rage had grown so familiar that it felt like reason. And when she put the knife in her purse that evening, she didn't see it as murder. She saw it as justice. Chapter 4, The Night. Everything changed. It was a warm spring evening in Pinellas Park, Florida, April 14, 2009. The kind of night when teens drove around aimlessly, music blaring from roll down windows, looking for something, anything, to make the quiet feel alive. At 8 p.m., Rachel Wade was at a friend's apartment. According to those present, she was pacing, restless, and fuming. She had just learned that Sarah Ludeman was once again with Josh Camacho, riding in his van, laughing, cuddling, acting like she had won. To Rachel, it wasn't just disrespect, it was provocation. She sent a flurry of angry text messages to friends. One read, "She thinks this is a game. I'm done." Another, "I'll do what I have to." Meanwhile, Sarah was in the van with Josh, parked near a friend's house. They were listening to music, talking about getting something to eat. Sarah had no idea what Rachel had planned. She thought the drama had hit a lull. Maybe it was finally blowing over. It wasn't. A deadly intersection. Just after 8:45 p.m., Rachel left her friend's apartment. She got into her car with a kitchen knife tucked inside her purse. She wasn't going to fight, she told herself. Just talk. Just make a point. Just be seen. But Rachel didn't park in a public space or near a friend's house. She parked near a dark street where she knew Josh often met Sarah. She turned off her headlights. She waited. Witnesses later said it was as if she was lying in ambush. At around 9 p.m., Sarah and Josh pulled up in his van, unaware that Rachel was nearby. Sarah saw the familiar car parked without lights. Her heart sank. She told Josh, "She's here." What happened next would be replayed in courtrooms, news reports, and nightmares. The fatal confrontation. As Sarah exited Josh's van, Rachel approached. Some say she yelled. Others say she walked straight up to the passenger side of the van where Sarah stood. There was yelling, brief, sharp, cutting, Witnesses say Sarah never threw a punch. She didn't have a weapon. She was unarmed. Rachel, on the other hand, had the knife. In the space of seconds, one single devastating moment, Rachel lunged forward and stabbed Sarah once in the chest. The knife penetrated her breastplate and pierced her heart. Sarah gasped, stumbled backward, and collapsed. Blood spread across her shirt. Josh screamed. Bystanders ran. Someone called 911, the call no parent wants. At the Ludeman home, Sarah's parents were settling in for the night. Her mother, Gail, would later recall that she felt something was off. It was late. Sarah hadn't checked in. Then the phone rang. It wasn't Sarah. It was a friend. "She's been hurt. You need to come. It's bad." Paramedics arrived at the scene within minutes, but it wasn't fast enough. The wound had severed vital arteries. Sarah had bled out internally before help could reverse the damage. She was pronounced dead at the hospital just after 10 p.m. She was 18. Rachel's arrest. Rachel didn't run. She stood a short distance away, clutching her phone, silent. When police arrived, she didn't deny the stabbing, but she claimed self-defense. "I was scared of her," she told officers. "She came at me. I didn't want to get hurt." But eyewitnesses told a different story. They said Rachel was the aggressor, that Sarah didn't lunge, that she didn't swing, that she was standing still when Rachel stabbed her. When Rachel was handcuffed and placed in the back of a cruiser, she wasn't crying. She wasn't panicked. She was quiet, blank. One officer noted in his report that she stared ahead as if in shock, but not remorse. At the police station, Rachel's interrogation began. She repeated her self-defense claim. She said she only brought the knife for protection. "I didn't go there to kill her. I didn't think. She was always threatening me." But